And our third and final case this morning is number 21-1649, Junker v. Medical Components, Inc. Okay, Mr. Zayer.
May it please the court. May I remove my mask?
Yes.
Alfred Zayer, Your Honors, for Medical Components, Inc. It is our position that the trial court committed several errors. Four specifically. One related to on-sale bar, because the product was on sale prior to the critical date. Non-infringement, because the plaintiff's own expert testified that 40% of the product was not available in the accused device, the hub specifically. Three, that it was not willful, because there was a letter that was sent.
So could you speak up just a little bit?
Pardon me, certainly. It could never have been willful, because there was a letter sent to MedComp about a different product that it purchased from another company. And that's the only thing that the plaintiff is relying on for willfulness. And finally, the article of manufacture, which is a highly contested issue. It is our position that the statutory reference that relates to infringement under 171 is the same as 286, that it is the design applied to the article.
Can I ask you about the on-sale bar?
Please do.
There is a letter in the record that's dated February. And I'm wondering whether that letter was agreed to and whether that resulted in a contract between the predecessor and Boston Scientific. Was there ever a contract entered into?
Eventually, yes.
When? Right, so there's...
I'm not sure it's in the record.
I'm just wondering whether... Do you consider the letter, the February 16th letter, which is at JA 1577 to 78, is that an offer?
It's the operative letter is the January 8th letter.
I'm asking about a different one.
I'm sorry.
I'm asking about the letter at February, it's dated February 16th, 1999. It's JA 1577 to 78. Was that accepted?
That letter added, if I am correctly, that letter is an additional letter that was adding two French sizes. I do not know if it was ever accepted. I believe it was because Galt was a primary producer of these sheath products and sold them to Boston Scientific and many other companies. So that product was eventually on sale. But if you're asking me if they accepted this offer, I cannot tell you that.
Okay.
But the acceptance of an offer doesn't change the fact that it's an offer.
I understand. I just saw some of the language used in this February letter is similar to the language used in the earlier letters, so I wanted to ask
yes,
that question.
I see. And the letter only adds new products. The most important thing about the letter is that the letter provides size, quantity, price, payment terms, and delivery terms.
Now you're talking about the January letter,
the January
right?
letter. Both okay. letters provide the same, actually.
Are you talking about the January 8th letter
January
now?
January 8th letter, yes, Your Honor. That's Appendix 00, sorry, that's Appendix 1572 to 1573. That letter, under this court's holding in Merck merely was found to be provided the essential terms of price, delivery, and payment terms.
But Merck didn't call itself a quotation, right? The letter in Merck did not refer to itself as a quotation.
Well, a quotation can be an offer. It does. If you quote, I'm going to sell you my pen for $5, that's a mere quote for a pen for $5. But if I tell you, I'm going to give you, it's a 1-inch pen, it's blue, I've got one of them, here's the price, I'll deliver it to you tomorrow on Tuesday, and I have delivery terms FOB this podium, it's very specific. The specificity.
I was looking at the restatement, and the restatement says that the word quotation is often used to convey, you know, just in a negotiation, that it's not an offer. And so that is where I realize there is The word alone doesn't indicate for sure whether it's a quotation or an offer, but I wanted to give it some meaning, and of course the district court did here below, so I don't think we should just shrug it off.
Well, it's clearly error because the UCC also says no one term can decide what the entire meaning of the offer is. So that's clearly from the UCC. You can't use one word. You have to look at the totality of the offer, and the offer is very specific. It's time, it's price, quantity, sizes. There are six sizes. These sizes are French sizes. That's the size of the diameter of the sheath. There are multiple specific individual offers.
How are we to determine what this letter is referring to, whether it's referring to the Panda design or not?
Because that's the only thing that they sold.
That's the only I'm sorry?
It's the only product that they sold. That is the handle with the sheath. That's the only product they designed and they sold. And it's not in contention. That is the product that was ready for patenting. Both parties stipulated to that. So it's
well, not... Where does that say that in the letter? How do we know that?
That was in the trial testimony within the hearing, within the trial, that we had before Judge Goldberg. It was irrefutable. That letter was referring to this device.
You're saying it's conceded.
I'll move on to the on-sale bar. Any questions further from you on the on-sale bar? Let me move on to infringement. The infringement issue is pretty clear. Mr. Bressler, plaintiff's own counsel, says that the products, specifically the tearaway, and there's two products. It's the valve tearaway and the tearaway sheath. I have them here to show you if your honors would like to see them. I don't know if you would like to see them. The products in issue.
Oh, well, we have... Is there really a dispute about whether these exhibits that you want to use as visual aids were exhibits in the trial? Let me ask Mr. Petruzzi if there is any dispute about that.
Your Honor, we have not seen these exhibits. The actual trial exhibits are either with the court in Philadelphia or they're with the record that was brought up here. What they brought to court, I understand, are models from their warehouse that they claim to be the same. And they may, in fact, be the same or at least a similar design. But we've never seen them. And I don't think it's particularly germane. I'll deal with that in my argument. But.
These articles are marked from the court. They are the court's articles.
They are the actual exhibits?
Yes, they are.
Why don't you show them to Mr. Petruzzi?
Yes, sir. The value of the exhibit is to show you the difference between the claim design and the actual accused product.
I believe the actual marked exhibits were documents and then separate physical versions of it were marked independently. I mean, they are the products that were at issue, so that I can see.
So you don't object?
Well, I do object to this whole show-and-tell presentation.
Well, I mean, that's you can't do that. You can only object that they weren't exhibits. It appears as though they were exhibits at the trial.
They aren't the numbered exhibits they're showing you, but they, I believe, a version of these...
Please stand up.
I believe these were exhibits in one form or the other. I just don't know if these actual physical pieces were the exhibits that we showed the judge.
They're marked as exhibits, right?
Well, as I said, the exhibits that were marked 19A and B were the documents that are in those folders there. The actual physical exhibits had a separate number. That's all.
Okay, but they're still exhibits. Go ahead.
Okay. The most important one, and I won't waste the court's time, is the valve tearaway. If you turn to, in our brief, if you look at the figures that are on pages 6 of the appellate's brief, you'll see figures 1, 3, 6, and 8. From that, a simple look at the product will indicate to you that it is nowhere similar. In fact, Mr. Bressler said it is the hub design is 40%, and it's not the same. So you cannot have substantial similarity when you only have 60% of the design. More importantly, what is the prominent feature? Is it, the plaintiff says it's these.
Which of the accused products are you showing us right now?
Valve tearaway sheath. There's two products, the valve tearaway.
I have super sheath valve 2.0,
yes,
or the super sheath valve.
This is the super sheath.
Okay.
And this is the valve tearaway.
Okay.
The super sheath we can concede is similar. But the valve tearaway has no similarity. The main element that they claim is similar is the rounded Mickey Mouse ears. But their own expert said 40% of the design is the hub. And you can see it's substantially different from the figures that are shown. And the prominent feature is the introducer. This is why they buy the product, not because of this. So that was presented at trial. Trial court found that, disagreed with that, based upon, and I think, an erroneous finding of fact as applied to the law. So, and moving on from that, Bressler conceded that the valve tearaway was not substantially similar. So the finding of substantial similarity in a design patent just cannot hold, in our view. I would like to move on to the issue related to willfulness. We received a letter, or it was alleged that we received a letter, in 2009. That was for a product made by Galt. That it was not a product made by Medcomp. Medcomp, 9 years later, makes the product, never receives a letter. No one says it's accused of infringement until we were sued. When we were sued for infringement, we moved off the design and redesigned. There's no evidence of willful, intentional, egregious acts of willful infringement. There just isn't.
So it's your view that it's not enough to know about the patent. You have to also be notified of what product is accused to infringe it?
Well, you have to at least be your own product accused of infringement.
I mean, that is the case for marking, but I don't know if that's the case for willful infringement. You just have to know about the patent, right?
But you have to have invidious, willful, intentional, bad acts of infringement. When we were notified by suit, the client redesigned the product. There is no basis to know that they intentionally continued to infringe the product. But the letter is for another company's product. Then there is testimony at trial that the chief vice president of engineering, no one who designed, made the product, or manufactured it knew anything about the Junker patent.
But just to clarify.
Yes, sir.
You agree that you had notice of the patent through that letter, meaning just that you learned of the patent, or not, or that your client learned of the patent?
The testimony of the client was that we don't contest it was mailed. We could not find any evidence that anybody received it or knew of that patent. We don't contest that it was mailed. We don't contest that it was
delivered. In your brief, you say that the 2004 letter was not notice of the patent. It's in your brief at page 45. But I'm having a hard time thinking that's true. You could have an argument that your client didn't willfully infringe, but that letter doesn't provide notice.
I would agree that we have notice. Yes. If someone sends you a patent, you have notice of a patent. That's the question. We cannot deny that. We don't deny that. But as applied to the accused article, we didn't even make that product until 9 years after that letter. So it's not really applicable notice. You just can't have notice of something 9 years later and be expected to remember that. When we were sued, we moved off, which is a mitigation of any willful intent. And there's no testimony that anyone who designed or manufactured that product within the company knew of that patent at that time. So I will move on to the issue of accused article. This has been a very controversial issue in patent design, and I think it's clear that the article itself, in this instance, is the handle. The patent title is for a handle for introducer sheath.
One of the concerns I have on this issue is I understand that the district court prohibited your client from introducing evidence on damages relating to just the handle. because it was submitted so late, and that that issue has not been appealed. Is that right?
And that issue has not been...
That issue has not been appealed. The discovery ruling or the exclusion of that damages evidence has not been appealed.
We did not appeal that, Your Honor.
And so that it is the case that there will be no damages evidence relating to the handle alone. Instead, the damages evidence is for an article of manufacture that includes the sheath, right?
And the introducer.
Right.
Right. And we and the introducer. We objected to that at the trial court, and that, however, our position is the article of manufacture, regardless of the damage information provided, that doesn't determine what's infringing. What's infringing in terms of the article manufacture is what the article is.
But this issue that you're talking about is for purposes of damages, and you're arguing that damages should be limited to the handle, but yet you don't have evidence on what those damages would be limited to the handle because it was submitted late and it was excluded.
It was.
So why should we even be addressing this issue?
Well, we believe the court erred in not including that evidence into the record. If this court concludes that the handle, the article of manufacture, the patent covers the handle, then we would hope that it would be remanded back for further proceeding regarding damages to the handle. The court has the damages to the handle. It's available. We made it available.
Well, it's their job to present the evidence as to if it's limited to the handle, to present a damages case as to the handle, right?
Yes, sir. We provided that.
Well, it doesn't make it's excluded, but the assumption is it properly excluded, but still they have to present evidence as to the damages to the handle if that's all they're entitled.
True, but if there's no evidence...
They don't have to make their damages case.
It's true. But our position is that the article itself is only the handle. So if...
Okay, unless there are further questions, so that, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll hear from Mr. Petruzzi.
May it please the court, Jim Petruzzi for the appellee, Larry Yunker. I wanted to just address one quick issue that Judge Saul had, and that was this February 16th letter. That's after the critical date, so it would not have formed a basis.
I understand that, but did that, was that letter accepted and then there was a sale? That's my question.
We have no evidence that that letter led to a specific sale. What we do know is that the letters sent prior to the critical date are mere quotations, and the court lays that out very clearly.
Mere quotation. If you look at the restatement standards, this was not like an advertisement or a broadly disseminated quotation. This was to a single person based on a prior discussion that they had. And it seems to have complete terms in it. So even under the restatement test, this would seem to be an offer, doesn't it?
Well, the doctrine that's been established is that the offer has to be such that a simple acceptance would make a binding contract. And here, you would have to not just say, I accept. You'd have to say, I accept 5 units at this price in this way.
Look, every time there's an offer for sale, it's up to the buyer to say how much the buyer wants, right?
That then is the offer. That's the purchase order. And in this context of these deals, that's what the witness said, that buyers make a purchase order and then we invoice and fill it.
That doesn't mean that the original quotation isn't an offer. They're accepted by saying we'd like 50 units at this price. Why isn't that a completed contract once that's done?
Well, again, the case law says it has to be by simple acceptance. If you're going to add extra terms, you're not just accepting an offer.
What case says that quantity has to be part of the offer?
Well, I just think in the context of what was being done here.
What he says that quantity has to be part of the offer.
Well, the quantity would have to be part of the offer. You wouldn't know what you're accepting. Suppose the guy...
He accepts, I accept your offer to sell me units, and the number I'd like is 50.
Well, I think the problem with that is that in these contexts, what you're saying is that a purchaser could say to the seller, I see your quotation, I'm going to ask you to sell me 10,000 units. That's clearly not how these operations work. They are done in a way that you put out your prices, you put out the product, and then the buyer makes a purchase order.
You're saying that's not how these things work, but that's not the evidence of this case. The evidence of this case, the testimony, is that this is how things work.
No, the evidence by Mr. Eddings was that purchasers make a purchase order, and...
Yes, but he said that he also said that in the business, this quotation is considered to be an offer to sell.
Well, I know he said that, but the fact is that the court was correct in finding that these were preliminary negotiations.
What other information would be required in order to make this a viable offer? If you look at it, it's got quantities, it has size, it has price, it's got sliding prices based on purchases of larger orders, and it even has all the terms for shipment, and it's got the terms for payment. I mean, why couldn't a person just rely on that and say, with reference to your January offer, send me 3,000 units size 4F at the price of $445, and I'll send the check within 20 days as required?
Well, again, it's our view that these are preliminary negotiations by the terms of the letter. It's still talking about what are your dimensional requirements. It does not specify a specific quantity and price that a simple acceptance would create a binding contract. That is what the case law says. That's why quotes typically are not contracts.
You're not able to cite any case that says that you have to that the offer has to specify a specific quantity. It's up to the buyer in accepting the offer to say this is how much I want.
I understand that in this context, it's the buyer. It's just like when you sell a house, you put it on the market for a price. Somebody can't just say, I take it. They are making an offer to you. You're inviting an offer from the purchaser to buy product at whatever quantity, sure. But you cannot force the seller, such as Mr. Eddings, who puts he'll sell 50,000 units for $470, to the production of 2 million units just because you come back and say, sell me 2 million units at $470. That wouldn't be a binding contract.
Is there anything else that's missing in this offer?
Well, I don't think it's sufficiently specific, given that the parties were talking about what they wanted, changes in the product, what the product might be done for specific purposes of Boston Scientific Corp. I don't dispute that the quote, like many quotes, lists price and quantities and other elements, but I just don't believe that that's sufficient under the law to create a binding contract by a simple acceptance.
I'd like for you to help clarify something for me, just real quickly, and I brought this up earlier. Am I correct that I heard you all say that this January offer is, everyone's conceded that this is directed to or involves or references the design patent?
I believe that at the time that they were making this proposal to Boston Scientific, this quote, they had a prototype of what later became the product that was then patented. So it was in connection with these products. It's not some other product.
And the parties conceded that? The parties have conceded that the letter involves a patented design?
I think we conceded that the thing that was shown at those meetings was a predecessor to the patented design, and it was ready for patenting. That issue, I think, was resolved. The issue at the court and what the judge went through was now.
To me, this is key because if anything's missing from the letter, it's what is it that's being sold? And at that, you know, it's not just these introducers. We're dealing with whether this is the design patent that we're talking about, and but you all have clarified that for me by saying that yes, this does, even though it doesn't say it, there's nothing here that would indicate to me that we're talking about the patent design, but you all have conceded here in court that that's exactly what this was.
It wasn't the patented design. It was a early prototype. They did not have these different sizes available. They were still not even at a point of manufacture. They were trying to generate.
That is, do you concede that the invention was ready for patenting?
I believe it was ready for patenting at that time, yes.
At the time of January 8th?
I think so, yes. Okay. But, again, it's our position that the nature of this kind of quotation is not sufficient to create a binding contract upon simple acceptance. So, unless there's other questions, that was the basis of our summary judgment, and that's why the court granted it, is because these were preliminary negotiations. And that's, he went through all that.
This is a legal issue, right?
Yes.
Both parties have moved for summary judgment, right?
Yes.
And the underlying facts, which includes the language of the letters, nobody disputes those facts.
The letters speak for themselves, yes.
That's right. And so that's what makes it an issue that's appropriate for summary judgment, right?
Correct. And the letters, within the letters themselves, indicate that these were preliminary negotiations. And that's why the court
rejected it. And you're specifically saying that this is preliminary negotiations because there isn't a quantity specified?
Well, there's language right in the letter itself that says if you should have any specific dimensional requirements, this product could generally be tailored to your specification. They don't even have a product yet that Boston Scientific might buy. They're still talking about the product, the design of it, what might fit their requirements. That's why we don't think it's an offer.
You have, for example, in the Supreme Court's decision in PATH, there wasn't a product available yet. In fact, it was a situation in which it was normal to make offers without an actual product in production. It's exactly the facts of PATH, right?
Correct. But what I'm saying is that the nature of the discussions, reading the letter, looking at what it says, we're looking at the negotiations. These are all facts. They're contained within the undisputed letter that lead.
Why does the fact that suggests that we could tailor our product to your needs suggest that what they're offering is not an offer that could be accepted?
Well, because it's, again, preliminary negotiations.
It doesn't say we can't tell you what the price would be unless we know what your requirements are. It says, here's what we're offering, and if you want something different, we'll talk about it. It doesn't make it any less an offer, does it?
Well, I think it makes the discussion exactly that, that it's preliminary discussions with the party. They're not in a position to simply accept that letter and create a binding contract. Otherwise, any quote that's out there that has any number of units for any number of prices, a buyer could come in and say, okay, I accept. Give me 10 million of those for $4. And I just don't believe that was the nature of this relationship.
It's not an offer to sell 10 million, but it doesn't have to be an offer to sell 10 million. It's an offer, and it gives quantities. It says for 5,000, you know, it's 445. And so somebody could say, I'll take 5,000 at 445. We don't have to deal with a situation in which they say, we'll take a million.
maybe
it's not an offer to sell a million, but that doesn't make any difference. All it has to be is an offer to sell one.
But it has to be such that a simple acceptance will create a binding contract. And in my view,
if they say we'll take 5,000 of the 4F-6F?
That's not a simple acceptance. A simple acceptance in the cases we were reading is I accept. Simple acceptance. Otherwise, you know, certainly if Boston Scientific said we would like 10,000 of these at the price, then Zentech would have accepted that purchase order offer and created a binding contract. I think the restatement, the UCC, both contemplate that there has to be simple acceptance.
Are we placing too much emphasis on the acceptance? I mean, the statute reads as to an on sale bar, and this is a design patent, not a utility patent or apparatus or something like that. Does that make a difference in this case that this is a design patent that we're talking about with respect to the on-sale bar?
I don't see where that would make a difference. I think the issue with on-sale You got to remember, this was not the patentee who put it on sale. This was a company that took the invention, who the patentee sued for breaching a confidentiality agreement and got damages against in 2003. I actually tried that case. They were the ones who were out there pitching this product in this context before they really had anything to sell. It was a prototype. They put these kind of quotes out to get interest because they're trying to get an order, purchase order, so they can then pay for the manufacture of the product. And that's the way this situation works with these companies. So, again, it's our position that notwithstanding that it has, you know, ranges of products, ranges of prices, an acceptance would not create a binding contract.
It creates, it actually says, it specifies quantities. It says 5,000. You order 5,000, it's 445. There's no doubt about the quantities, is there? It's available, that's made by the offer. They've offered to sell 5,000 for 445.
Well, the way I read that in the context of these kinds of quotes is these are various ranges of product. You buy up to 5,000, it might be the one price, and then the next and the next. So, you know, again, there's no doubt that it has a price, no doubt that it has quantities at that price. The question is, under the UCC and restatement, would it form a binding contract by simple acceptance?
This has more than quantity and price. This also has all the terms of shipment. It speaks in terms of FOB, Athens, Texas. It's saying that from the factory gate, it's going to be yours. It's going to be non-sterile, net 30 days, shipment in bulk.
Well, Mr. Eddings also testified that he wasn't able to identify when he could ship because he knew he didn't have a product to ship. And so, yes, I agree. It says what it says. But, again, it's no different than any other price sheet that lists quoted products. You know, FOB, you know, Athens.
It is different than other price sheets in that it's directed to a particular company, right? It's directed to one party. I mean, don't we have in the restatement, it says one of the factors to consider is the number of persons to whom a communication is addressed?
Well, this was their standard quote letter. We didn't go into that in the underlying case.
Is there evidence of that, that it's a standard quote letter?
Not in the record, no.
Okay.
Yeah, but I can...
I mean, Mr. Eating's declaration would seem to suggest something different.
Well, he was trying to make a sale, obviously, to Boston Scientific, but he wasn't offering to sell. He was talking to them to get them interested, getting them to say, I want this French size, I want these dimensional requirements, then he would go make them if they made that order.
And this, do I remember correctly that this January 8th letter was in response to some earlier communication?
Well, I don't know that. We had a hearsay objection at trial about that issue. The letters are the only record evidence the judge relied on for purposes of the on-sale bar. We were looking at these letters.
Well, it says thank you for this opportunity to provide this quotation.
Right, well, that's the hearsay issue. You're testifying in the document as to what maybe Boston Scientific said.
We're looking at the document. The question is to figure out whether it's an offer for sale. We look at the document. There's nothing hearsay about.
Well, again, it says it's a quotation, and I think the judge relied on that because of the restatement, because of the UCC, and because of the doctrine that requires simple acceptance. So that's the basis of the decision we think was properly done in that case.
We'll give you a minute to address the other issues if you want.
Well, I don't think on the article of manufacture, I think your point is well taken and exactly right. It'd be moot basically to rule on that at this point because they did not appeal the exclusionary order. There
but,
is no evidence.
Who has the burden of proving damages?
Well, we did, and we did prove damages, and we proved it with respect to the article of manufacture that throughout the litigation, both parties agreed it was the entire introducer sheet.
But if the article of manufacture was the handle, which might be a factual issue or a legal issue, it seems to be disputed here, if it were the handle, that would be your burden to prove what the damages are, right?
Well, we did, though, because the handle is not a separate component, and so that design, as applied to the defendant's products, is the whole product. The introducer sheet is the product, just like the Apple case was applied to a phone.
But I don't know if you heard, but Judge Dyke answered the question I asked pretty well, and he said that, well, it's not your burden to prove damages. So how do you respond to that? I mean, I made a point, but I'm not sure it's well taken anymore, given that it's your burden to prove damages.
Again, we did prove damages because we proved damages.
So in other words, maybe it doesn't matter whether their damages evidence on the handle were excluded or not. We still should address this issue.
It is a fiction to say there would be damages on this handle by itself. It's never sold separately. It's never made separately.
That would probably be a fiction in many cases then, right? Well, what you're saying makes it so the Supreme Court's ruling would never apply in a situation where the smallest saleable unit is something less than what the design covers or is affixed to.
No, it would be if you looking at the Apple factors, meet the various factors, that it is separable, that it is sometimes sold separately, it might be considered a component.
So your view would be it's only when it's sold separately that you're entitled to a portion, if you will, or identify the article of manufacture as being only that part of a device on which the design is affixed.
Well, this is sort of a backdoor apportionment argument that's being made, but if the item you're talking about is separately sold, and you can identify that, I think certainly you could probably assess damages because there is a market for that thing. Here, the judge applied the design to the product, as the case law says, that the defendant is selling. And so the product that's being sold and the way it was marketed, specifically touting these features, that's the article for which damages apply, which is a different, I think the case law is fairly clear, that's a slightly different analysis than, you know, what the claim covers.
Though, it's not a per se rule, right? There is no per se rule of the type that you're advocating, right? There's no per se rule that for a multi-component device, the article of manufacture will always be the full device. There's no per se rule like that. Even if the device, the full device is the only thing that's sold.
Well, I would say that and the converse that they're arguing is there's no per se rule that because the design patent shows one thing, it can't be applied to something else.
And
in the case of article manufacture, both parties agree it's based on factual determinations entitled to clear error, deference to the district court. So I believe that the damages that were given are the damages for the infringement being the sale of the introducer sheath, which shows this very prominent feature. And if we go back to the district court, because of the exclusionary order, there is no evidence for them to argue an alternative damage number. It was their damage theory.
They're arguing that it was up to you. If it's a smaller unit, that's the basis for damage. It's up to you to show the damages with respect to that unit.
Well, I contend that we did show the damages with respect to that unit because it's applied. It's applied to the overall product that all the parties agreed was the article manufactured throughout the litigation.
Okay, I think we're out of time. Unless there are other questions. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Mr. Zayer, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just to pick up on the on sale issue, all the cases that were cited by the plaintiff, and there were many of them, each and every one of those was missing a material term. Quantity was not in one. The cases that were cited was the ML, MC, LTD that did not have, it was just a price quote, just $5. It didn't have any terms whatsoever. The Arrow case, there's no price, it has no quantity. The Medflow case, it was a flyer. It was just sent out to everyone. There is not a single case that plaintiff has provided that says a offer that has a price quotation, offer delivery dates, quantity, and the rest is just not an offer. It's an offer, as I think as Your Honors were pointing out. And the one that was pointed out, the 11 French at $5 or $5,000, $10,000, Galt and the the prior company, Zentech, was owned by Galt. Galt was a major manufacturer of equipment, and it sold to Boston Scientific, who's known to everyone. These were real specific offers made by specific companies to specific people. It's an offer for sale, in our view. Plaintiff never had damage expert, never provided damages. We did our best to provide damages. Once the Luxembourg case came out, we then scrambled to provide an article of damage. But it's not our burden. We did our best at this trial to help the court determine what the real values were, and that's why we provided damage information. Plaintiff provided no damages. It is their burden. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted. That concludes our session for this morning.